And welcome to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. We have a great show for you today, so stay tuned. But we're going to start with some music from Ernest Ranglin, the famous guitar player from Jamaica. And he put out an album not that many years ago, but could be 10, 15, 20 years ago. But, you know, he's had a long illustrious career. And he put out an album called Memories of Barber Mac. And so here is a tune off that album called Dance Hall Fever.
Thank you.
And that was Dance Hall Fever by Ernest Ranglin. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Ryan Young. Recently, I sat down with David Wees, who is a faculty lecturer in the plant science department here at McGill University, and he is also the associate director of the Farm Management and Technology Program. And of course, that is also known as FMT for short. David is always up to all kinds of environmental projects and is an avid gardener and somebody very interested in urban agriculture. So here is the interview I did with him last week. Now, this is Ryan Young with Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM, and I'm here with David Wees, who is a lecturer in the Plant Science Department of McGill University and also the Associate Director of the Farm Management and Technology Program here at McDonald Campus. And David has been involved in many different environmental projects over the years, and so I thought it would be great to talk to him a bit about his teaching, but also about some of these environmental projects, which have been funded sometimes through the McGill Sustainability Fund. So how are you doing today, David?
Excellent. A beautiful day for an interview.
Exactly. It's a nice warm day in April. I guess tell me how you got hired here at McDonald Campus as a lecturer.
Oh, so I got hired actually in 1988. My predecessor had moved on to New Brunswick to a job with the Department of Agriculture in New Brunswick. And so I started teaching there, basically teaching the production courses in horticulture. And then from there, I sort of migrated to a few other courses over the years as well.
And what do you like about teaching here and being in this milieu?
Well, a number of things. One, of course, is sort of the physical location. There's lots of green space. Also, it's a relatively small campus, which means that you actually get to know most of the people who actually work here or study here, which is really nice too. And there's lots of really good people, lots of people who I've been able to work with over the years, and that makes a nice sort of family feel to the campus.
Nice. And in terms of horticulture, it does have a horticulture center, right? Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Yeah, so several different things. There are aspects of horticulture on campus. One is the Horticulture Research Center. A lot of people know it better as the Mac Market because there is a market on location. What people don't see is behind the Mac Market, there's actually a roughly 14 to 15 hectare space that has apple orchards, other fruit orchards, pears, grapes, and things like that, and a large number of vegetable fields. And that's used a lot both for teaching and research. And then the other aspect is our greenhouses. So we actually have, at the moment, two greenhouse complexes. We will have a third. One is actually going to be rebuilt soon as we speak. So we have two out of three that are actually functional at the moment. And so a lot of that space is actually used for some of the teaching programs too. Well, we're hopefully getting our new greenhouse in the fall of 2023. So our old greenhouse called the Raymond Greenhouse was torn down basically this spring. And they are now in the process of cleaning away the debris and rebuilding a new one. The original greenhouse, I believe, was built around 1910. I've seen some old photos. It was then parts were added to it and it was modified over the years, but I think the original structure was around 1910. And so hopefully in the fall of 2023, we'll have a brand new greenhouse, which will be nice and new and modern and have all the bells and whistles on it.
Nice. And describe some of the courses that you actually teach.
So I teach in the Farm Management and Technology Program, I teach the production courses related to fruits and vegetables and greenhouse crops and landscape design. And at the undergraduate level, I also teach a greenhouse course and a course that I started about 10 years ago called Urban Horticulture, which focuses on all the uses of plants in the city environment, whether it's turf grass, street trees, rooftop gardens, green roofs, green walls, and things like that.
So in that kind of course, at least regularly, maybe not during the time of COVID-19, but you must have done a lot of field trips and a lot of exploring, I guess, things that are going on here in Montreal.
Well, in the urban horticulture course, a lot of what I have the students do is actually some sort of more term-type projects, but practical ones, where I ask them to design some type of horticultural intervention in some sort of urban space. And it's kind of a long roundabout way of saying it could be home landscaping, but it could be redesigning a park or a section of a park. I've had one group of students who designed a sort of pedagogical garden for a daycare center. Another who designed a green space for an abandoned lot downtown Montreal. Another group designed a green roof for a large, one of these big box stores, things like that. So it's been sort of a real mix of things. Because that course is given in the winter semester, there's only so much we can do outside, although we do a few outdoor labs in February or March when it's not quite so cold. Things like trying to evaluate the health of trees, of street trees, but also trying to evaluate what sort of impact those trees can have on the urban environment, whether it's mitigating air pollution or creating shade to reduce the urban heat island effect and things like that.
And in terms of the farm technology and management program, a lot of people don't really understand what that program is because we're sort of on a university campus, but it's a SAGEA program, right?
Right. It's sort of an unusual thing. It is, as far as I know, the only example of a college, a CEGEP level program offered in a university. And this is largely for historical reasons. The ancestor of the Farm Management and Technology program, we call the FMT program for short, actually goes back to 1907 when the McDonald campus was first founded. And this was actually one of the very first programs offered. In those days, it was actually a one-year program. And then over the years expanded to a two, to a two and a half, and now it's a three-year program, similar to the technical programs that you'll find in CEGEPs. Many of the students, I'd say most of the students who come into the program already have some farm background. Either their parents have a farm, or maybe their grandparents or aunt and uncle or cousins or neighbors are farmers, and they actually plan to go into farming themselves when they graduate. So that probably covers maybe two-thirds of the students. The other third is sort of a mixed bag. Some are city kids but would like to get into farming, or maybe at some point had a summer job in a farm or an orchard or a greenhouse or something like that. But it's really meant for people who plan to get into agriculture in the production side of agriculture in one form or another.
Okay. There are some projects that you have been involved in more recently that involve tree planting on the campus. Can you tell me a bit about those?
Sure. So a couple of years ago, we started something called the McDonald Campus Tree Planting Initiative. And one of the objectives was originally to plant 200 trees in honor of McGill's bicentennial, so 200 trees for 200 years. And it seems simple enough. You say, okay, well, we'll just buy 200 trees and plant them. But as soon as you want to start to plant something on a university campus, there's a little bit of paperwork to go through. So we did have to not only get the funds, but get permission from the university, not only so we could plant, but where we could plant. But the other objective was to increase the amount of diversity of trees on campus. So although there are a lot of trees on campus already, over the years certain groups of trees have been planted, and always there were certain species that were chosen. So for example, many years ago, a lot of ash trees were planted on campus. Unfortunately, because of Edmal ash borer, most of those trees are dying and either have already been removed or will be removed soon. So those had to be replaced with something else that would not be attacked by that particular insect. Another tree that has been often planted, and sometimes overplanted, I think, in urban areas, is the Norway maple, which in some ways is a good tree for urban areas. It's a fast-growing, it's relatively tough, doesn't have very many pest or disease problems. But there are so many that it's, in a way, it's kind of decreased biodiversity in urban areas. So those, we started off with constraints. When we chose the trees, we wanted to make sure we didn't plant a tree that would become a problem 10 years or 20 years down the road, that would somehow improve biodiversity on campus, but that would also meet the needs of a particular site. Example could be, if you're planting near a road, you're going to get road salt. So therefore, you have to plant trees that are tolerant of road salt.
And then you even planted some bushes, right? And there was some attempt to go for indigenous species or native species.
Yeah, that was another objective, is when possible, we wanted to plant species that are native to eastern Canada. And again, there have been some examples of things that have been planted over the years that are not native that resulted in problems. A good example actually is the European buckthorn, which was widely planted in the early 20th century because it's virtually unkillable. So people thought it would be great as a great shrub to plant almost anywhere. The problem is, because it's unkillable, it now is spreading and growing everywhere, including places where we don't want it. So yeah, we didn't want anything that would sort of take over and get out of control. The other reason for favoring species that are indigenous to eastern North America is that indigenous species tend to favor indigenous birds and indigenous insects. So it's not just a question of saying, hey, I'll plant a sugar maple because sugar maples grow in Quebec, but I'll plant a sugar maple because it'll also favor insects and birds that also are indigenous to Quebec.
Absolutely. That's great. And then some of the other projects that you've been involved in with that have been funded through the McGill Sustainability Fund. Can you describe some of these others?
Yeah, so the most of the other projects I've been involved in revolve around the Horticulture Research Center. So there's one sort of ongoing program called McGill Feeding McGill, where basically the Horticulture Center is more or less mandated to supply most of the fresh fruits and vegetables that are served at McGill's cafeterias. This started about 10, 12 years ago, if I remember correctly. And pre-COVID, it got up to the point where in the fall semester, McGill Feeding McGill, basically the Horticulture Center, was able to supply about 3/4 of the fresh fruits and vegetables served in McGill cafeterias. Winter semester is another story because we don't have the greenhouse capacity to produce year-round, but at least in the fall semester that has worked out pretty well. Another project that I worked on more recently that was funded through Sustainability Projects Fund was to redo a huge chunk of the orchard at the Horticulture Center. We have a number of apple trees that are getting rather old. I mean, 40 years doesn't sound old to some people, certainly not to me, but in the life of an apple tree, 40 years is past its prime.
And an apple tree, I guess, just stops producing as well at that point, or gets more diseased?
In theory, apple trees can actually live to be 100 years old, but usually once they reach 30 to 40 years old, productivity starts to decline. You tend to get more pests, more diseases. And so it's normal every 30, 40 years that you'll start replacing trees. So that's what we did, but it was more than just replacing trees and just replacing with the same. We know that apples do have a lot of disease problems, and because of that, they get a lot of pesticides. And one of our objectives was to actually reduce the quantity of pesticides being used. And so one of the strategies is to plant varieties of apples that are less sensitive to common diseases. So that's what we did. We did plant some Macintosh, which is a common variety that everybody knows, but we also planted some other varieties that are much more tolerant to disease. So lesser known varieties, there's one called William's Pride, another one called Liberty, another one called Nova Spy, which are all much more resistant to disease. Personally, I like Nova Spy. That's my favorite of those new ones.
Is it a bit like a Spartan apple, or?
Yeah, Nova Spy actually tastes quite a bit like Spartan. It's crunchy, it's a little bit later ripening than Macintosh, dark red, but it has the same type of sweetness that Spartan has.
Nice. So you planted some of these varieties, and then some of them were even trained on wires, right?
That's correct. So the trend now with most new apple orchards is instead of planting very large trees planted very far apart, say 8 or 10 meters apart, is to plant much smaller trees much closer together, what we call a high-density orchard. And because the root system is much smaller, if you don't stake or tie the trees, sometimes they get top heavy. Basically, the fruit is so heavy that the tree can actually collapse. So they're actually trained, if you look at them, they look vaguely like someone training a tomato plant on a stake or a trellis. except in this case they're trees that'll be maybe, you know, 3 meters, 4 meters tall. So they're all supported with posts and wires.
You know, I think it's true we're in a period where there's a lot more interest, a renaissance of interest in urban agriculture, in local agriculture, in using less pesticides and so on. Is it an exciting time to be in this domain?
Yeah, definitely. As you mentioned, there's been a real uptake in interest in urban agriculture around the world, but we've noticed particularly in the Montreal area, a lot of new initiatives, and new initiatives in all sorts of directions. So some is sort of very commercially oriented, people wanting to basically make a living out of some form of urban agriculture. Those often tend to be more sort of, I guess you could call the high-tech approach, you know, using hydroponics, greenhouses, growing indoors, they call plant factories, things like that. But also at the community level, people trying to develop collective gardens or gardens with special purposes, for example, at schools, daycares, senior citizens' residences, where the objective there is not so much to produce a lot of food, but to generate an activity for kids, for people with reduced mobility or things like that.
And your own diet and your own food practice or whatever, are you a gardener? Do you like to forage, or do you like to, you know, make a lot of homemade things?
Well, we definitely have a lot of homemade gardens. When we moved to Sainte-Anne de Bellevue, we moved from a place with a large lot and a huge garden to a place with a much smaller lot and a much smaller garden. So we compensated by joining not one, but two community gardens. We have two community garden plots, plus our vegetable garden at home. So when we tell people we practice crop rotation, it basically means we rotate between three gardens, three different locations.
Sounds similar to me. What kind of enjoyment do you get out of that, and why do you think you get enjoyment out of it?
Well, it's fun at a couple different levels. One, it's fun to be able to choose what you're growing as opposed to just accepting what's on the shelf at the grocery store, which means sometimes you get to try some things that are a bit less common, you know, not the stuff you find all the time. It's also fun because you know whatever you're getting is really fresh. You picked it and you eat it the same day or the next day. It's not been sitting in a truck for a while. And, well, it's good exercise just to be outside as opposed to sitting in the office all day.
Nice. And you were a student here at McDonald campus as well. And
yes.
Did you have any mentors or any teachers that you really liked when you were a student here?
Yeah, I had several teachers who were really, really good. Some, it's sort of odd when I think back to it. One, it was actually my statistics teacher. You know, who would have thought, you know, all these years that I would have loved studying statistics? That was Professor Fanous. I also had Bob Koch, who taught computing. And again, it's sort of funny that I'm in horticulture now, but that I liked my computing course. And I also had a great teacher, unfortunately, I can't remember her name, but who taught me botany, who was only here for 1 year. She was here as a replacement. But I really loved my botany courses, too.
I wonder what would you say about this, or your perspective on this is, of course, there is a herbarium, I guess you would call it, here at McDonald campus,
right. Mm-hmm.
And Frida Beauregard, I think, is still the director or curator,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or whatever. And the more things go towards, you know, I don't know, genetic research or genetic engineering, or the more things become computer oriented, mm-hmm. the less there is this interest in these original kind of pressed plants, you know, which you would see in something like a herbarium. But I think there's still value in that, and maybe there are people that are kind of, some people are going back to that. Or do you have anything to say about that? Or
It's kind of hard to say. I mean, people more interested in the older specimens, sometimes for historical interest. I mean, it's kind of neat to see a plant that was dried and pressed 100 years ago. In fact, I had a student whose grandfather was a student here in the 19, just after World War I. And she had his plant collection, and she brought it to me. So this is not her grandfather, her great-grandfather's plant collection. So she showed it to me. It was really fun to see something dated 1919 or 1920, so 100 years ago. and her family had kept it, so that was fun to see. But certainly, I mean, even in the botanical side, we're moving a lot more towards digitization, so photos of plants as opposed to the plants themselves.
But I imagine that's the nice thing also about an institution like McGill University, because it's an old institution, it still has things like this, a herbarium or like the rare books collection. Or
yeah, so I mean, it is fun to see some of these older things, and certainly you walk around on campus simply to see, well, there are some really old trees here. There are some older buildings, and it's interesting just to see how those buildings have evolved. So for example, where we have the library, the Barton Building used to be a barn. And so, in fact, if you walk past it, you can say, oh, yeah, that looks sort of like a barn. But, of course, the windows have been redone, the roof has been redone, but it still has that barn shape to it.
And why do you think students enjoy going to school at McDonnell campus? What do you think is part of its attractability?
Well, certainly just the appearance of the campus itself. And when people come to visit the campus for the first time, if they come during the summer or the fall, they say it's great, there's so much green space. Lawns, trees, gardens, flower beds, and so on and so forth. And I think the other thing that they really come to appreciate is that it's a close-knit campus, which is hard to get when you're in a really large institution.
For example, your office is in an old building, right?
Right. So my office is in a very old building, and in the winter you know it's old because there's no insulation. It's cold, but it does have a certain character to it. So there are old windows, but at least the windows open.
Nice. So that's in Harrison House, right?
That's right, yes.
Do you have any upcoming projects that you'll be working on in the next couple of years, or things you're trying to do now?
Well, we are actually having a bit of a follow-up to the tree planting initiative. Amazingly enough, we actually came in under budget, okay, which is rare in this day and age where we spent less than we thought we were going to spend. So we got permission from the Sustainability Projects Fund for an extension on our end date, which was supposed to be in the winter of 2021, or fall of 2021, sorry. So we will do a final phase of tree planting in the fall of 2022. We're still trying to figure out the exact location, but we're hoping to plant maybe another 25 to 30 trees someplace on the campus in the fall.
Nice. And do you ever have any connection with John Abbott students or John Abbott College, because it's the neighboring institution?
Yeah, well, certainly because they're close by, we sometimes have occasionally interactions, but one that I've been having for a number of years is with the Honor Science program. This goes back maybe 10 years now, where usually in the fall, the Honor Science class will come and visit the Horticulture Center, and we'll do basically an outdoor workshop. So we'll go and do things like test the sugar content of the grapes, or test the temperature of the soil, or the how much water is in the soil, and things like that. And I think it's fun for them because, I mean, they're science students, but it's just to show them that, yes, there's science in, you know, growing vegetables and fruits. There's science involved in that, so it's a nice link.
And how do you test the moisture in the soil?
Well, there are different ways. There's the indirect way where you basically just stick your hand in the soil and squeeze it and see if you can actually make makes a sticky ball, or if it crumbles into bits. If it crumbles into bits, it's dry. But we were lucky this year. We were able to get some money from the Provincial Ministry of Agriculture to purchase some new lab equipment for teaching. And so, among other things, we got soil moisture meters, which look like a giant electrode that basically you stick in the ground. And the principle is quite simple. If the ground is wet, you can run electrical current through it. If it's dry, you can't. And so depending on how wet it is, you get more or less of an electrical current. Not enough to shock anybody, but just enough to run a little electrical current through the soil.
I've even heard some old farmers claim that to find out how fertile a soil is, you could taste the soil.
I've heard of people doing that, tasting the soil. I've never tried it myself, at least not intentionally. Maybe I swallowed some dirt accidentally. I've heard that you can get an idea if the soil is more acid or less acid, depending on its taste.
But otherwise, that would be discerned through another kind of meter of some sort?
Yeah, there are a number of different ways of doing it. So you can, for example, just use a pH meter. You basically take a sample of soil, mix it with water, stick the pH meter in, and it tells you, is it acid, is it alkaline? But there are other meters that will measure nutrient content sort of in an indirect manner. So yeah, you can do that too.
So Mike Blayo, who has worked at the campus for so long at the Horticultural Center, he's retiring, right?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
So have you had a long, good relationship with him over these years of doing projects?
Oh, definitely. Mike has been a real help in many different ways. He was very involved in a lot of the sustainability projects over the years, McGill Feeding McGill in particular. But he's also helped out a lot with a lot of student activities. Mike is very good at grafting fruit trees. And so every year he's come into one of my classes and showed the students how to do grafting. So he does a little demonstration. He brings in branches from fruit trees and has the students actually do grafting. So that's been a real help.
And every year you do a plant sale, right? And that's, I guess, plants that were grown in the greenhouse that are now looking for homes?
Yep, so of course with the pandemic things sort of got messed up a bit, but in normal times we would do a plant sale usually around Easter. And so the students grow various plants during the semester. This year we grew miniature roses, strawberry plants, gerberas. The students also propagated some orchids and some house plants and things like that, and they prepared those for the plant sale. So what goes into the plant sale sort of varies from year to year depending on what the students have grown.
And so students often come in and purchase plants for their home.
Yeah, so our big customers, of course, are the students on campus, plus the staff. We have some staff who come every year and will buy some plants, which is nice.
Nice, nice. Well, thanks so much for talking to me today, David. It's been great.
Oh, thank you very much.
And that was my interview with David Wiese, who is a faculty lecturer in the plant science department at McGill University. He's based out at the McDonald campus, and he is also the associate director of the Farm Management and Technology Program. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. And now we're going to go to Democracy Now! They had a recent interview with The Economist, Jayati Ghosh, and it was to discuss rising inflation and how all of this inflation and the war in the Ukraine with Russia invading Ukraine and so on is having a worse effect on the developing world compared to the developed world. And so here is that story from Democracy Now!
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We look now at the soaring price of energy and food around the world. The U.S. Labor Department said Tuesday inflation in the United States rose by 8.5% in March, the highest it's been in 40 years. Meanwhile, Oxfam's warning over 260 million people could be pushed into extreme poverty by the end of the year due to the pandemic and rising energy and food costs. Oxfam International said, quote, without immediate radical action, we could be witnessing the most profound collapse of humanity into extreme poverty and suffering in memory. For more, we're joined by Jayati Ghosh, economics professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, previously an economics professor at Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi, India, where she taught for 35 years, just appointed to the UN Advisory Board on Effective Multilateralism. Her recent article on the increase in commodity prices following the Russian invasion of Ukraine is headlined, Putin's War is Damaging the Developing World. We welcome you to Democracy Now! There is a lot of news in the United States, Professor Ghosh, about inflation, with the numbers just out yesterday, worst in 40 years. If you can talk about that and then put it in the context of the world.
Yes, absolutely. There's no doubt that it is high inflation, and it's much higher inflation, I think, than many people, including in the administration, expected. It's driven really by the fuel prices. And Food prices matter, but to a much lesser extent in the U.S. It's dominantly the price of oil that is driving this. There are supply chain issues in a number of other smaller areas like automobiles and so on. But this is a cost push inflation, as economists call it. It's a rise in costs of fuel, which is something that is used in everything else. It's used in the production of many, many other goods and services. It's used in transport. And so it doesn't just affect the prices at the pump. It actually affects all the other prices in the economy. The problem is that then governments say, oh, well, what we have to do is to get the central bank to tighten monetary policy, to raise the interest rates. That's not the problem, because that's not the solution. That doesn't affect the cause of the inflation. So you really have to think of different measures in this situation.
And what parts of the rising inflation or what percentage roughly do you attribute to the invasion and the subsequent sanctions against Russia, and what part to structural problems within the world economy in general?
This is a very interesting question, because we know that both these prices, food and fuel, were rising even before the Ukraine war. What happened thereafter is a dramatic and very sharp increase, even beyond the increase that we were already getting. At that time, before the Ukraine war, the fuel prices accounted for about 30% of the increase in U.S. inflation. Now it's more like half of the proportion of inflation that it's determining. But the prices themselves have gone higher than you would expect, given the actual impact on supply. It's absolutely true that, you know, Russia is a major exporter of oil and natural gas, but hey, its volumes of exports haven't fallen that much. They've just been diverted to other countries. It's also true that both Ukraine and Russia are major suppliers of food grain. Ukraine does wheat and oil seeds. They also supply fertilizer. So all of those are impacting food production globally. But the prices have actually shot up well beyond what you would expect through just that supply decline. And that's because there's been very feverish speculative activity in what are called the commodity futures markets. These are markets anticipating the price 1 month from now, 3 months from now. And those prices have just gone haywire over the last 6 months, with massive involvement of speculative activity and then declines in them as they rush out of one commodity into another. So a lot of the destabilizing impact of speculation on what are called these futures markets is impacting the current price, the spot market, as well.
And there's been an economic impact on the global south, obviously from inflation and fueled, as you say, also by the after effects of the war. But there's also been, and this hasn't been noted too much in the media coverage in the West, a sharp divergence in public opinion in the global south about this war versus the public opinion in the West. In countries like Indonesia, some of the largest countries in the world, Pakistan, Brazil, China, public opinion is much more sympathetic to the Russians than it is to Ukraine, and certainly much more so than in the West. I'm wondering why you think that is happening.
Well, let me take your second question first. I think what is really striking, and I don't think people in the West realize it, is the extent to which the hypocrisy in the sort of moral double standards are evident in this Ukraine war. I mean, yes, it is terrible what is happening. It is a brutal and completely unjustified invasion, and people are dying and people are suffering. But more people have died in Yemen in the last 3 months with arms provided by the U.S. and very, very brutal attacks. People, children are starving in Yemen and in Afghanistan because of U.S. policy. And so, you know, everyone else in the world is saying, how come it's only when they are white Europeans who are affected that you care at all? I think I don't think people in the West realize the extent to which they have absolutely lost moral legitimacy in terms of the very, very different reaction they have exposed in this war to white European lives and all other lives in the rest of the world. This is not lost to anyone in the developing world. There is a very, very strong reaction. And this is going to affect all kinds of things. It's going to affect the possibilities for multilateralism. It's going to affect whether G7 has any standing at all to ask countries to do anything. And it's going to affect whether people go along with the US and Europe in doing sanctions when the US and Europe wants to do it, but not for other equally terrible acts that they themselves are party to. So I really do believe that people in the West need to wake up and realize how much damage has been done to their own conception, very limited conception of, you know, what is moral and ethical, when the rest of the world is very, very evident of what is going on.
I was wondering, Professor Ghosh, if you can talk about the actual corporations, if you could name names of the large corporations that are making a killing off of what's happening right now, that are making huge profits. I mean, we know when it comes to, for example, gas, and many people in the United States have asked, they would say, well, people are paying $5 or $6 because of the war, Russia's war in Ukraine. But it turns out that ExxonMobil and BP, all these oil companies, are making more money right now than ever in their history. If you can talk about the same when it comes overall to inflation and food prices as well.
So this is the whole issue that, you know, once you get some increase in prices, companies see this as a terrific way of quickly making additional profits by raising their prices even more than is justified. So, yes, there is, as I mentioned, this cost push element. But what you're also getting is profiteering, plain and simple. So companies, as you mentioned, in the oil sector, companies in the food sector, companies in a range of other sectors are raising their prices much more than is justified by the increase in their own costs. And they can do this because there's a whole atmosphere of inflation expectation. And this enables them to, there are no limits. I mean, this is a time when really you have to have public policy which is regulating companies like this. And it's possible, the governments can do it. You have to regulate the companies that are openly profiteering. You have to set some controls on the prices of essentials that enter into all other prices. And fuel is one of them. You really have to make sure that those prices are regulated and determined. So the notion of this free market is completely false, because these are big, fat as companies, oligopolies, that can control the market. And so you really have to make sure that governments regulate those prices. The same thing is true internationally. We are getting the big players in agribusiness raising prices of basic grains and foods well beyond what is justified by the increase in costs. And this is affecting people in the developing world who are already much worse off than those in the US and Europe, who already experienced the pandemic much worse because they had decline in employment, falling livelihood, falling money wages. They haven't had a recovery. Their governments haven't had the money to spend that has been spent in the US and Europe. They are still well below levels of employment that were there before the pandemic. And now they are facing these huge increases in food prices and fuel prices that really are just going to make massive increases in poverty and hunger globally. So we have to address the problem at the root, which is in terms of the ways in which prices are structured, the companies that are allowed to get away with straightforward profiteering in times of crisis, and bring in regulations and controls that will prevent that.
And in speaking of these protests that have begun to develop, especially in the developing world, in Sri Lanka, there was a mass protest over the cost of essential goods. And on Tuesday, the country stopped its international debt payments, effectively defaulting on its debts. Do you foresee a potential debt crisis across the developing world as a result of this, of these inflationary forces?
Yes, absolutely. And this is something we had predicted a year ago, actually, even before the Ukraine war. The Ukraine war has, if you like, accentuated and intensified the problem. But it's not just economists like me. The IMF has predicted this, that if you don't do something about, first of all, the huge overhang of debt that already a lot of countries had, then the knee-jerk response of countries in the North, US and Europe, to raise interest rates, so capital, all the capital comes back to these countries, and then you get massive volatility and capital flight from all the developing countries, you're going to get massive debt crises. This is just the beginning. This is, if you like, the first step in towards the abyss.
I wanted to ask you about the inquiry that you're taking part in today with Progressive International, which was founded by, among others, the independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, as well as Yanis Varoufakis of Greece. Can you talk about the inquiry into the IMF and how that relates to what we're talking about?
Well, you know, I think many people based in Korea are going to be arguing that the IMF has been guilty of many sins of commission and omission. I think the sins of commission are very important, but they're well known. Let me quickly highlight. The IMF goes into countries that are in deep crisis and says, cut public spending. And it's part of the way they are supposed to somehow bring these countries back into balance by saying, you reduce government spending, you impose austerity, and investors will feel more confident. Private investors will then come flocking in. That rarely happens. All that happens is that the problem gets much, much worse. There are many ways in which the IMF has had a very double standard, again, in terms of the rich countries and the not rich countries, the middle income and low income countries. Because in the rich countries, they say, yes, spend more. You have to be counter-cyclical. You have to revive the economy. In the middle and low income countries, they say, oh, you have to cut down on your spending because you have to reduce your deficit. You have a very large debt. You have to make sure you can somehow reduce that debt in the period of crisis. So in turn, they then demand extra fees and commissions. They impose surcharges on the countries that are worst off, that have had to take IMF loans for a longer period or take larger IMF loans, which is absolutely ridiculous. It's the IMF making profits all out of a catastrophe in all of these countries. So these are the sins of commission, which are very great and have had devastating consequences across the world, really. But the sin of omission, I would argue, is actually even greater. The IMF is the only multilateral agency we have today that handles global finance and can think of international financial arrangements to do with crises, to deal with the challenges that humanity faces. We don't have any other structure. Now, humanity, we know, first there was a pandemic, we know that there could be well more pandemics and so on, but there is climate change, which is, again, already upon us, which is affecting agricultural supply, which is affecting coastal sea rises, which is affecting livelihoods, which is causing already significant increases in environmental destruction, in hunger, in employment loss, in people having to move, displacement, all kinds of things. You have to bring in massive public spending. And the IMF is the agency that can do it. Where is the ambition that can actually provide this minimal funding for the huge climate challenges that we face globally? And which really, again, you can't be nationalist about this. Climate doesn't respect passports and visas. It's not stopping to wait at the border. It's going to affect everybody if we don't do something now. And the IMF has been remarkably unambitious, sluggish, I would say, really not doing the minimum that it's supposed to do. It was created just after the Second World War in a very, very, very different world with this power structure that is completely ridiculous now, with the U.S. being able to block everything, U.S. and Europe controlling 60% of the voting rights and all that. But as a result, it really hasn't moved to do the basic things that a multilateral organization that is in charge of global finance has to do. Prevent private finance from doing.
And you were talking about climate change. You mentioned climate change. How has the eruption of this war affected efforts in various countries? Even in the United States, we're seeing President Biden backtracking on some of his proposals in terms of reducing our carbon footprint. Could you talk about the impact of the war on climate change?
It's very unfortunate that the Ukraine war has shown that whenever there is any immediate crisis, governments across the world are going to not just backtrack, they're going to reverse on all of the commitments in terms of carbon emissions, in terms of moving to greener energy, in terms of everything. So even a war like this, which is, let's face it, a limited war in one part of Europe, is causing everyone in the world to completely forget about all of their major promises and strategies. Some countries going back to coal, some countries emphasizing, you know, the dirtier kinds of fuel, forgetting about all of the attempts, instead of saying, well, look, now let's actually push for greener energy because oil prices are high, let's push for greener energy. They're saying, no, quickly grab all the possibilities for the dirtiest energy possible. It's the United States, it's Europe, it's India, it's China, it's everyone in the world. No country has actually, or very few countries, have actually said, let's use this as an opportunity to move much more directly into green energy sources with public funding, which is really what should be the response. This is terrifying because it means today it's the war, tomorrow it can be anything else. Governments are not committed. They're not seeing the writing on the wall. They're not recognizing the clear and present danger of a climate catastrophe.
Jayati Ghosh, we want to thank you for being with us, economics professor at University of Massachusetts Amherst. Her recent article we'll link to, following the Russian invasion of Ukraine, headlined, Putin's War is Damaging the Developing World.
And that was Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! Interviewing Jayati Ghosh, who is an economist who is based in India. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. You can always email us at ecolibrium@ckut.ca. You can follow us on Facebook. You can follow us at our website, equilibriumradio.weebly.com. Or you can check out our affiliated podcast, which is at equilibrium.podbean.com, or just look for it on Spotify. So we're going to leave you with some music from 1984, I believe. And this is a duet, sort of, with Ruby Braff on cornet and Gene DeNovi on piano. And I love the vocal in this jazz song, this particular rendition of this jazz song, because it's understated. It's so unusual. So this is the song He Loves and She Loves from the album that Ruby Braff put out, I think around 1984, called The Canadian Sessions. So yeah, here is He Loves and She Loves. Have a great day.
Birds love and bees love and whispering. Trees love, and that's what we both should do. Oh, I always knew someday you'd come along. We'll make a twosome that just can't go wrong. He loves and she loves and they love. So won't you love me as I love you? Can't blame me for feeling amorous. Hear me.
The National Greening Program, run by Tree Canada, is dedicated to planting seedling trees across Canada in BC, the Prairies, Ontario, Quebec, and the Atlantic. They prioritize planting on Indigenous and public lands and planting areas of natural and human-caused disturbance. The trees they plant help filter the air and water and sequester carbon, among other positive impacts. To learn more or get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
As you have been in our neighborhood.
All right, we get our neighborhood real hot. Everybody's going for something. We alone, there are too few of us. There are too many men up there with all their cop cars and everything.
That's what they're always telling you.
Never let your enemy tell you how many of you there are. Never let the man that you're against form your opinions. This is the trick that's played on everyone who's oppressed. The first thing an occupation, when you have a revolution in the country, the first thing you take over is the radio. And then you start telling the people that everybody, the war is over. And so all of them surrender. No, they believe that thing right there. And once they take that over, they start telling you where you are and where they are, and you fall right in line. It's plain thought control. The majority of the American people aren't segregationists. That the majority of the American people aren't imperialists. But the government is, the structure is, the power faction is. So, how then do all the majority go along with it? Because those who sit in power over the television, over the radio, and over the press is constantly telling those who are the masses how free they are.
Rewind!
This young lady right there.
I'd like to make a comment, Mr. Malcolm. Now, you're right, of course, the black people are in the worst.